Speaking in Myanmar, but talking to China from APM. It's the Marketplace Midday Update. I'm Jeff Horwich. Welcome to Thanksgiving week, everybody. It's November 19th. President Obama is in Southeast Asia today. We'll talk about that. Americans' credit card debt is on the rise again. We'll take a look at who might be taking over the Twinkie. And if you, like me, are hopelessly addicted to Chobani yogurt, or maybe if you just want to hear from one of the most remarkable business success stories of our time, we've got the founder and CEO of Chobani. That's all coming up.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
During the campaign season, we heard President Obama talk about America's strategic pivot of attention to Asia. Well, today he's been making good on that with a trip to Thailand, Cambodia, and Myanmar, also known as Burma. Obama's trip to Myanmar is the first by a sitting U.S. president, and it's seen as something of a reward after the military dictatorship began to open up its economic and political systems. Here's the president speaking today at the University of Yangon.
America's lifting our ban on companies doing business here, and your government has lifted restrictions on investment and taken steps to open up your economy.
U.S. companies from Coca-Cola to MasterCard are checking out the business opportunities in what was one of the world's last closed economies. Yangon, like Myanmar itself, has two names. The pre-dictatorship name for the country's biggest city is Rangoon, and that is the location of the BBC's Southeast Asia correspondent this morning, Jonathan Head. Good to talk with you.
Good morning.
A lot of the focus of this trip, at least here in the U.S., has been on the geopolitics of it, the U.S. working to counter China's influence in the region. But for the countries that President Obama is visiting, what are the economic consequences of closer ties with the U.S.?
I think the U.S. has always been a key trading partner. I mean, in the end, this is a manufacturing part of the world. There's enormous potential here for Burma to catch up. It's got a motivated workforce, an educated workforce, and all of these countries are really looking not just for U.S. leadership in strategic terms, but they're also hoping that the U.S. economy finally starts to sputter back into life, that the recovery President Obama has been trying to get going finally happens, because for them, that is where some of their richest markets, their richest demand is.
We've been hearing about what a gold mine Myanmar could be for foreign companies now that it's opened up. Is that being overhyped, you think, or is there really something to it?
I think people need to be very careful. This is a country that is extremely rich in resources. It's got a lot of oil and gas. It's got rich timber resources, a whole lot of other mining resources, and it has a potentially motivated human population who are desperately poor. You know, wages will be low for a long time. All of that offers great potential. But it's still the reforms that have happened here are very recent. They came out of nowhere. This is a government that was created by a very secretive military regime. It's moving in a democratic direction, but the rules are still not clear. So I think it's probably a very risky place to invest. People coming in here could make, right now, at the beginning, could make a lot of money. They could also lose their shirts.
The BBC's Jonathan Head in Rangoon. Great to talk with you. Thanks.
Good to talk to you too, Jeff.
And let's do the numbers. Well, after a week in the doldrums last week, things are looking up, at least so far this morning. At this hour, the Dow is up 1.3%. The S&P 500 and the NASDAQ are both up more than 1.5%. Stocks rose today throughout Europe and Asia. Sales of existing homes rose more than expected in October. The National Association of Realtors says sales grew more than 2%. The national median price was $179,000, and that's up about 11% over the year before. Home sales plus more confidence of a compromise on the fiscal cliff, perhaps, could be driving investor optimism to start this holiday week. But are we getting too confident? The credit report company TransUnion says our average credit card debt per borrower grew 5% in the latest quarter. That average debt is now almost $5,000. The proportion of late payments also rose in recent months. Katie Porter is a law professor at UC Irvine who tracks consumer finance issues. Good to talk with you. So one would have thought that during this great recession we just had, we'd have learned a thing or two about managing debt and not taking on too much debt. Do these numbers suggest that we're falling back into our old ways?
The uptick that we're seeing in credit card debt is not by itself alarming. I think we have to remember that for most consumers, their larger debts are their mortgage debts and their car debts. So we really want to think about this number in relationship to those other kinds of debts and looking at the overall portfolio of how much families owe and to whom.
Seems to me there are two different ways for this statistic to materialize. Can you tell if this is lots of people racking up just a little more debt or whether really it's an issue of a smaller number of folks racking up a lot more debt?
Yeah, it's hard to say for sure, but I suspect that it's a large number of people making a modest uptick in their debt. And I reached that conclusion in part because we're not seeing much change in delinquencies. That is, people who are 90 days overdue, very, very small increase, and still a sort of historically low delinquency rate. So what that suggests to me is that we've probably got most consumers feeling somewhat more confident. They're reaching for that card just an extra time or two a month. They're making a little bit larger purchases, but that if we were seeing a few people sort of gorging, what we'd see is a spike in that severely delinquent rate, and we're not seeing that.
A little deeper down in the fine print of these TransUnion numbers is another interesting number. Banks are issuing more cards. That could have something to do with it.
Right. And banks issuing more cards is actually usually good news for consumers. What we want to see is responsible and careful use of the card. What we don't want to see is sort of, you know, the amount of borrowing spike.
This week, we're really looking at kind of the start of the holiday shopping season. I think it's safe to say that now. Do you think this foretells kind of a lavish holiday spending season all put on plastic?
I think it's a small, modest kind of optimistic indicator, but I don't think it suggests that consumers are sort of going to go out and binge this Christmas.
Katie Porter, Consumer Debt Authority and Professor of Law at UC Irvine. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
And before we leave the topic here, you're likely familiar with the gold card concept in the credit card world, right? If you're a really top customer, really high roller, you get special services and such. But mostly you get the smug pleasure of knowing that your card is especially shiny. That is particularly so in Kazakhstan, where Visa is teaming up with a local bank to offer a card made of actual gold and mother of pearl and embedded naturally with 26 diamonds. Only the top 100 customers at the Kazakh bank are even eligible, and it costs $100,000 per year. Oh yeah, one more perk worth mentioning. You can't swipe it. Other than that, it's very useful.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
We have been telling you all about the fiscal cliff, and it ain't over yet, but there's another January 1st deadline facing the lame duck Congress. The current Farm Bill extension expires at the end of the year. The bulk of the money for the bill goes to fund food stamps, now called the SNAP program. As Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports, some in Congress are pushing to rein in those benefits.
In the last 4 years, an extra 15 million people began receiving benefits from the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. Altogether, the program cost the government $80 billion a year. Congressman Jim Jordan of Ohio is critical of the program's expansion.
1 in 7 Americans now rely on the taxpayers to take care of their nutrition needs. That needs to change.
He would like SNAP recipients to pass an asset test, proving that they need the funds. But others say the risk of fraud is overblown. Maura Daly is spokesperson for the hunger relief organization Feeding America.
SNAP is one of the most efficient programs with the highest rates of accuracy of any federal programs run.
Professor Craig Gunderson at the University of Illinois says the expansion of the SNAP program is nothing to worry about.
Whenever the economy goes bad, it expands. That's what it's designed to do.
Gunderson says cutting SNAP benefits would be a mistake because this is when low-income Americans need the program most. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
After Superstorm Sandy, the electricity went out for more than 1 million homes and businesses serviced by LIPA, the Long Island Power Authority. The lights are now back on for everyone except those whose homes were badly flooded. As Tracy Samuelson tells us, though, LIPA now faces criticism over how it responded to the storm.
There you go. Thank you. Good.
Susan Papademos and her husband Gus usually walk their dog in a park 5 blocks from their house.
But now they're here to pick up a warm meal from a temporary Red Cross station.
We lost the whole first floor of our house.
They also lost power for 2 weeks.
You know, we have a two-story house, so maybe we've been living in the cold in the second floor.
Before the electricity was restored, they say they saw a National Grid crew just standing around on their street.
So we said, hey, are we getting power? Well, the story was, you could have gotten power last night. We're waiting for a LIPA to give the okay.
Dr. Matthew Cordero is the chairman of Suffolk County's LIPA Oversight Committee. He says LIPA has a slew of long-known problems, but is also the only public utility in the country that contracts out its day-to-day operations to a for-profit company, National Grid.
The result is a severe problem in communication and coordination between the two entities.
And with customers. A few miles north at a FEMA center, a commercial fisherman named Sean, he didn't want to give me his last name, said a crew on his street told him he'd have to hire an electrician to inspect his home before the power could be restored.
He's like, you got to get an electrician in to prove that you could get the main breaker turned back on.
LIPA and National Grid didn't return my calls or emails. But LIPA says on its website that outside inspections are an option for people who don't want to wait for their crews, but it's not required. Sean hasn't heard anything directly from LIPA. His house is cold, he's got bronchitis, and he's been eating MREs from FEMA. Those are the meals the military gives soldiers at war. Still, he's sympathetic to everything LIPA's dealing with.
It's a disaster, so I don't think anybody was truly prepared for it. I mean, I'm sure they're doing what they can.
Others aren't quite as tolerant. Both the New York governor and state attorney general have launched inquiries into how LIPA and other utilities in the area handled the storm. From Long Island, I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
There was no New York City Marathon this year, of course. Mayor Michael Bloomberg decided to scrap it in the wake of the storm. It was a last-minute controversial call. But the cancellation was an economic boon to another marathon just down the road. From WHYY, here's Elizabeth Fiedler.
Many marathoners who plan to run in New York's famed race are apparently determined competitors, like Michael Froelich. He's a legal aid lawyer from West Philadelphia.
When the Hurricane Sandy came through, decided that it really probably wasn't a good year to run it, and then was a bit at a loss about what to do next.
He was also at a loss financially.
I gave up the registration fee, which is about $250, which kind of hurt.
He says he didn't want to throw away months of training. So like over 1,000 other displaced New York Marathon runners, he signed up for yesterday's Philadelphia Marathon, which meant shelling out $200 more.
In some ways, running is kind of a cheap sport. But you don't need a whole lot of equipment. On the other hand, when you start thinking about the entry fees, it starts to add up.
Because he lives nearby, Froelich didn't have to deal with the cost of last-minute travel and booking a hotel room. Alexis Greiner, a runner from Massachusetts, also signed up for New York. She also ran the Philadelphia Marathon, and she ended up crashing with in-laws who live nearby.
If we had to pay for a hotel, we would have definitely thought more about it. We're fortunate enough to be able to pay for this. I mean, it's not ideal.
For Greiner and the other displaced New York marathoners, it was worth the cost to run a race they've spent months training for. In Philadelphia, I'm Elizabeth Fiedler for Marketplace.
In 2005, a Turkish immigrant named Hamdi Ulukaya took out a loan from the Small Business Administration, and he bought a closed-up dairy plant near South Edmiston, New York, kind of right in the middle part of the state. 2 years later, the first cup of Chobani Greek-style yogurt went to market. Since then, Chobani has taken Yoplait and Danone to school. In 5 years, it has become the top-selling yogurt in the U.S., and Ulukaya is one of the country's newest billionaires. The company now employs about 1,200 people. They're about to open another giant yogurt plant in Idaho. Hamdi Ulukaya, welcome to Marketplace.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So you're something of an overnight success, and now you are, I would think, a giant target. You've got enormous international companies that are gunning for you, General Mills, Danone, maybe Nestle. What's your plan?
Well, our plan doesn't change from the beginning. You know, if you look at the yogurt aisle, which has never changed in the last 20 years other than the marketing messages, now it's changing. A startup like Chobani has challenged, what's been there for a long time.
So you started Chobani with help from a small business loan from the U.S. government. Are there any lessons from your experience for this economic recovery?
Yes. Jeff, if you ask people in that little community inside Edmiston, And if you say, what's the worst thing happened? They would say, closing this plant, which was bread and butter of that whole town, of that region. But if you look at the same plant now, which has close to 2,000 people working, if you ask, what is the best thing ever happened? They would say, closing that plant. I am really thankful to SBA. Without SBA loan, I couldn't buy that plant. I couldn't start my business. And now, you know, we're reaching to $1 billion in business and still 100% independent and thousands of people working. But it has to start with some light.
Now, I am, of course, an impartial journalist, but I will also disclose that I eat a chobani pretty much every day. And lately, I have wondered, I don't want to scare you here, but I have wondered if I'm starting to burn out on it. How do you deal with that?
Well, yogurt has been around for hundreds of years. You know, I grew up in Turkey. We couldn't imagine a meal any given day without yogurt. So I consider yogurt being as like bread, like, you know, honey, like pomegranate. It's like olives. You know,
you cannot conceive of somebody burning out on it.
Totally not.
You're saying.
This is not something that in and out. This is something that's been around for thousands of years, yeah.
Well, but you do have to deal with the fact that people are going to want to start sampling different things, right? And how do you diversify when consumers, right now at least, really only identify you with a single product?
We continue to do what we do best. Of course, consumers, you know, will try other things. You cannot have 100% of the marketplace anytime, which we don't. We only have 21%. For me, it's not what's the percentage of share the Chobani has. It's about how much people will come to the category. You know, you face that the 40% of our population here in the country is not touching yogurt. So there's so much to gain there. I don't look at what's the percentage of Chobani's market share. I look at, you know, what is the total market when it comes to yogurt consumption.
So you're not so worried about people like me getting bored when there are so many other potential customers still out there?
Well, I don't think, you know, you can get bored with yogurt. I really don't, as long as we do it right.
Hamdi Ulukaya is the founder and CEO of the yogurt company Chobani. Been good to talk with you. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff.
Just a quick correction here to something I mentioned to you on Friday when we were talking about the Hostess company going out of business. Some early reports had mentioned that Hostess owns Little Debbie, and we relayed that information on to you. In fact, Little Debbie snack cakes are owned by McKee Foods, totally separate company, which in fact stands to be one of the biggest beneficiaries if Hostess brands disappear from the shelves. Twinkies, Snowballs, Donettes, Wonder Bread, these are all Hostess. But before you mourn a little piece of your childhood here, all is not lost. Hostess today begins its liquidation, which is a process where buyers can snatch up valuable brands and assets. One rumored buyer, a global bakery conglomerate from Mexico. Here's Marketplace's Scott Tong.
Grupo Bimbo is a $10 billion company that gobbles up other food brands. Consider the crumbs on your tie right now. Grupo Bimbo owns Thomas's English Muffins and Entenmann's. It reportedly tried to buy Hostess a few years back. Bob Golden is with Technomic, food industry research and consulting firm.
They're good at the cost side of the business. I think the jury's still out of whether they can take a brand and significantly enhance it.
He figures Twinkie may be the sweetest brand on the block. News of Hostess winding down and consumer nostalgia has naturally landed the remaining yellow treats on eBay, $100 a box.
You know, it does have some sort of magic about it still that perhaps a new owner with some investments in marketing could revitalize.
The first task will be neutralizing online jokes about Twinkies, Ho-Hos, and a company spelled B-I-M-B-O. In the end, the Mexican multinational may be laughing. If it buys Hostess brands and shifts production, Mexico has low-cost sugar. Ingredient number one, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
And finally, wrapping up here, the end of the election has brought a bit of a rough patch for old Donald Trump. Nothing came of his contest to dig up President Obama's college transcript. His tweets calling for others to join him in a revolution to march on Washington or something like that really went nowhere and made him kind of a pariah. And then the Trump Steakhouse on the Las Vegas Strip gets shut down for health violations. 51 of them, to be specific, from expired caviar to improperly thawed raw tuna. The Trump Steakhouse has now reopened with a clean bill of health, so head on out and have yourself a meal. But I kind of want to know, didn't anyone get fired? That's all for the Marketplace Midday Update for today, November 19th. I'm Jeff Horwich. This is APM, American Public Media.